doesn't matter how you feel. It doesn't matter what you think. The real truth is the objective.
All of the great scientific discoveries have happened under a Christian worldview.
We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise.
All right, part three of your non-trilogy. We are back. Maddie Trost, Wade Mobley. Should we put a warning, like a flashing warning sign? Philosophy incoming.
Smoke the whole pack. Okay, so full disclosure, or mostly disclosure. Okay, so I had a sabbatical a couple years ago, and the one educational activity I did, I took a remote class with Nancy Piercy on the logical argumentation of C.S. Lewis's essay writing. It was so nerdy.
Broadly applicable to...
So nerdy. It was so much fun. It was great. So, okay. And then I taught an SIT class.
Yeah.
Just a few of those. It was a lot of fun. So all that to say, I got things. Okay. The goal of the apologist is to simplify and explain the Christian faith. It's not to answer every question.
Yep.
But it's like, what are we talking about? And increasingly, when I was a kid... Yeah, the evangelistic enterprise in Lake Placid, South Dakota was probably some version of, you're all something Jesus-y, but do you really believe any of that?
Hmm.
There's not that common cultural fabric, and there wasn't really as much then either. Church of England was a different story. So what he was appealing to was a broadly held, lowest common denominator Christianity, but a genuine common ground, not a meet me halfway, because that's Hegelian, and he very much was against that.
The dialectic.
If not by name, right? Yep. So he did a really good job of simplifying and explaining the Christian worldview. And I think he did it. He did it as a classicist. He was not as concerned about evidence as he just kind of went with it.
Arguments over evidence.
Arguments over evidence, and he philosophically answered all the questions. We didn't talk about miracles.
Oh, I will.
Oh, you will. We'll get there?
I want to get there when we get to some of your argumentation.
Two editions of miracles as well. So there's an older edition that he actually he completely rewrote a section of it after receiving some feedback from an atheist friend.
Yeah. Taking philosophy, intro to philosophy, and coming in contact with Hume, and I didn't realize that, oh my goodness, Lewis has a whole chapter on Hume, and
that's what he rewrote.
Yes, yeah. It's so good. It's so good and so practical. Yeah, that's great.
So he called it Hume's. He called it Hume's more respectable skepticism.
Yeah,
as opposed to the skeptic who just says, "Ah."
It's pretty easy to dismiss Hume if you don't really understand him, because his popular argumentation is entirely circular.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like Hume's explanation of why miracles can't exist is textbook, this is what circular reasoning looks like.
Oh, exactly. And that's Lewis's whole point on it.
Right.
So he goes on to say in miracles that you can't do science.
Right.
You can't trust your own.
Yes, you can't trust. And it's so interesting that he points out that Hume's philosophy has to be based on the universals of the Christian worldview in order for it to even be plausibly brought up.
And he we didn't talk about this last episode. That's his argument from reason, the apologetic for the Christian faith, is if the human mind developed as a product of random chance, it is no longer a reliable explainer of the
Correct.
World.
Yeah. Exactly. Yes. So you can't do, Nancy Piercy talks about freeloading atheists.
Yes.
Yeah, trespassing.
Finding truth.
So you get saved or get off the lawn. That's not Herbert's, but that's, what's the guy on up?
Carl Fredrickson.
They can get saved or get off my lawn if he's a Christian. Okay, all right. So, the way he applied it, though, today we would call that cultural apologetics.
Yes.
Interacting with the way people are thinking and what they're interacting with. A lot like Francis Schaeffer did. And cultural apologetics is, I think, probably the way people tend to think today. So that's good. I've actually got notes here. I feel like this is less organic now. I'm ruining our brand.
No, you're not. This is good because this is a hybrid. Because Maddie's a news anchor.
Yes,
she's got the tap staring into the camera.
So all of these books, these essays, you can find them. Probably just find them online. I'm sure they're public domain. But there's all these collections, and the versions I've got, I just bought out of the bookstore. Yeah. Okay, so, you know, God in the Dock has a bunch of essays. And then what's the other one?
Christian Reflections.
Oh, yeah, Christian Reflections. Yeah. And so these are all essays. They're 7 or 8 pages long. They're formal essays. And he was a master of the formal essay. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing you teach our students to write.
Yep. Okay, so I tried.
So they come here. Many of them have 100 level comp. Okay. They've never read or written a formal essay.
Yeah, and I think that's because mostly we read a lot actually in our culture, but it's all subtext for 30-second videos on Instagram and TikTok.
Well, and that's where you get like the TLDR.
Yeah. Very rarely is it a formal argumentation in the way that Lewis writes.
So TLDR, read a book.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So it's very helpful. So you can I saw a stat one time, the number of people in our society who are functionally literate, like they can read, but as far as engaging with ideas and articulating, that the majority of our population is unable to read. So it's kind of like, I can read enough Spanish to order. It doesn't mean I know Spanish. So, okay. All right. A genuine common ground, and genuine is probably the biggest part of that. Heavy on the natural law. So natural law is undefeated. You can't. So the questions, I think there was a Senate hearing last week where they were asking a doctor, can a man get pregnant?
And no comment.
Well, it's like no comment. He talk. It's like, well, this isn't even a question. Natural law is undefeated. Gravity and market forces, it exists. It isn't a construct. Logic. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's an existence. It's an ontology, not a construct. So, okay. Specific topics in his work. I tried to boil it down to 3 because, you know, we tend to think in threes.
Because you're a pastor.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. The subject-object distinction. And all of a sudden, I feel so nerdy.
Now?
Yeah. Okay, so the subject-object distinction. So here, John Warwick Montgomery, mid-20th century, wrote on the crisis in Lutheran theology, 1970-something. The crisis in Lutheran theology, as he saw it in America, was the loss of the subject-object distinction, which is a philosophical category that enters into theology. In theology, the subject-object distinction can be illustrated in John 11, 25 and 26. I am the resurrection and the life. That's object. Okay. Do you believe this? Mm. That's subject. So the subject, do you believe this, doesn't really matter if the object isn't true. If the object is true, your subjective interpretation or analysis or reception of that is very important.
Yeah.
And Jesus was not being a synergist when he makes this declaration about his person and work and then asks, I always get this wrong, was it Mary or Martha? Which one did he ask? I cannot keep them apart.
Which question are you trying
to
ask?
He says, do you believe this? I am the resurrection and the life. Lazarus, yet he shall die, yet he shall live.
You got a 50-50 chance, just own it.
Mary.
All right, here we
go. Told Mary. And then he's going to put it up there. Yeah. It was actually Martha. Yeah. Okay, okay. Do you believe this? Jesus was not being a synergist. What he's saying is, this is true.
Yeah.
Do you believe this? Those are both important questions, but one is predicated on the other. The object has to be true for the subject to matter.
Yeah, and the theological distinction there, it's the same language, but we talk about objective justification and subjective justification because it is the personalization of a truth that matters for everyone.
Yeah.
And so the objective truth is Jesus is the savior of the world. Jesus died for the sins of the world. The do you believe it is that matters to me. It's the difference between 1 John 2:1-2, Jesus is the propitiation for our sins and not only for our sins, but the sins of the whole world. And Galatians 2:20, I have been crucified with Christ and Christ now lives in me.
The reason why I was actually looking at my notes is that I'm realizing there's so much overlap.
Yeah.
On these topics, and that's how he thought,
works.
Right? So okay, great. Okay, so the subject-object distinction. One of the essays in one of those books, "The Poison of Subjectivism," and his thesis on that one is that subjectivism, and do we probably need to define that?
Yeah.
That there is no objective truth.
Yeah.
of any kind.
What you can believe is fine. The moon is made of cheese, and I can believe that the moon is a rock, and those two things can be true at the same time.
Yeah, subjectivism is the ancestor of relativism. Yeah.
Yes, yes, good, good. And so the truth of the moon is green cheese, that's from my class. Yeah. The moon is entirely made of green cheese. The truth is found in the samples of the moon.
Yes.
Not your observation.
Not my observation,
right?
Of the cheese.
So, okay, so that's a major distinction. So in The Poison of Subjectivism, he says, his thesis is that subjectivism is, it provides opportunity for the oppression of totalitarian states.
Hmm.
Because if there isn't an objective truth, my word's not his, you might makes right, whoever has the most votes or the most guns wins.
Yeah. What's the line from 1984? The greatest deception of the state was its most important that you could not trust your eyes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The freedom is the freedom to say 2 + 2 = 4.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. Okay. Great. So the poison of subjectivism. So romantic, philosophically romantic, utopic societies, Northeast United States. We've talked about that in that little throwaway episode we did where we started talking about dystopian literature. And where that came from. So philosophically, Rousseau, not Rousseau, different thing, two S's, Rousseau, romantic philosopher. Okay, what survived from Rousseau into Bolshevism, into communism,
Social contract.
The Hegelian dialectic of not thesis antithesis, but thesis antithesis. Synthesis, that the truth is always someplace in between.
Yeah.
That's the dialectic of Hegel.
So you're always a revolutionary.
Yes. So you're always, yes. So once you arrive there, the revolution devours your own children.
Mm-hmm.
So, because there is no objective truth. So he also has an essay on the humanitarian theory of punishment in one of those books.
You do sound like a nerd.
Okay. So here's his argument is, if punishment is for deterrence, not for the fulfillment of justice, it doesn't matter if the guy's guilty. All that matters is that this person was punished. So in 1984 terms, yeah, they always confess.
Yeah.
Okay. It doesn't matter if they're guilty. What matters is that everybody sees this person was punished for this crime.
And I mean, it's really, I mean, this is non-Lewis, but it is really surprising of these dystopian kind of novels, how often that's a theme, because that's the central thought to Fahrenheit 451.
Well, that hideous strength is that.
Yeah. So Fahrenheit 451, the climax is they can't catch the guy.
Yeah.
So they catch someone else, punish him, and society is satisfied.
Okay. So that's also how I remember what I can put in my oven safely or not. It's a flash point of paper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
You right. Know how hot it gets.
Don't put in parchment paper at 500 degrees. No. Things get bad.
Yes.
So, okay. All right. So the subject-object distinction, that's a thing.
That's great.
Okay. The next one is scientism or logical positivism. He's against it. He's against it. He doesn't like it. And part of that is the subject-object distinction again. So the abolition of man.
This is probably
so
abolition of man is having a moment right
and,
now.
And it's so nerdy because the original foundation of the book is his objection of a grammar book.
The green book.
So like all the English people are just... We love this.
And we're not going to do it here. You can go online.
You can find the green book.
Find the green book. They've identified
yes.
it. But
it's actually a book. Not the movie. But there's actually a grammar book.
Yes.
And what it's for the lower forms or upper forms of what we would call elementary school.
Yeah.
So think fourth, fifth, or sixth grade.
Yep.
And what he's saying is, he tells the story of Coleridge at the waterfall. I don't know British literature. All right. So, and one of them says, it is, how
this
sublime.
Is sublime.
Sublime.
Right?
And then the other one says,
"This makes me feel
sublime." And that
feelings.
Would be in our, and that'd be good. I would say sublime. You'd say, "What do you mean sublime?" That'd be you. Yeah. That'd be good. So what he's saying is, there's nothing sublime about the waterfall. It only puts into you feelings of sublimity.
Yep.
So you're making a comment about yourself, the observer, the subject, versus that which is being observed, the waterfall, the object. And so he goes. So who cares about this? Well, he very quickly says, who am I to say, who are you to say that there's honor and valor in going off to war on the continent.
Mm-hmm.
If it's only, it puts into you feelings of valor and nobility or whatever. So he says, I can convince you to go to war so I don't have to. No, it's simple manipulation.
It's very cynical.
It is. But I think he's right. Yep. And, okay, and this is, maybe this is cynical, but I also think I'm right. In our culture right now, nobody thinks. It's vomiting reactions. We have created stimulus response machines where they're incapable.
We let other people think for us.
Exactly. And the short form video thing has made it even worse.
Yeah.
This is
this short form video-ish.
Ooh, yeah, well.
Mid-form?
Yeah, we're guilty as charged. There's a whole study on the shift in language on this topic mm-hmm. where people used to say, I think.
Oh,
and
in
now
class.
They say, I feel like.
Yeah.
In class.
And this is what we're talking
this
about,
is,
this phenomenon.
Is
this still happening in class? You ask him a question, well, I feel like.
Yeah, I feel like God isn't like that.
And yeah. I told him one time, I don't care how you feel.
Yep.
That probably could be more. Anyway, all right. So, okay, I really don't care how you feel.
The cool thing with this, though, is it doesn't matter how you feel. It doesn't matter what you think. The real truth is the objective. And that's what he's pushing us to actually find the substance.
Well, and it's undefeated, too.
Yep.
Sometimes it feels a little bit like, oh, man, I wish I were educated. Why do you men with books quote to us laws? Quote to men with swords your yeah. laws. Is it Cicero? Talking to Marcus Aurelius or some such thing.
Wouldn't it be interesting if we had
Cato? I don't know.
Maybe somebody could look that up.
Yeah.
I feel so uneducated. Anyway,
we're gonna get comments.
But it kind of feels like well, yeah, you might be right, but who cares? I have a gun.
No. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but all this comes back. I remember I grew up in the 80s, and I remember when Christians had this noble thought that we should not objectify women. And we were called prudish and puritanical. Okay, so certain TV shows, if you've watched 80s reruns, it was really bad.
Yeah.
Okay, and now everybody's walking around saying things like we shouldn't objectify women.
And the Christians are like,
that's what we've been saying for a long
it's like,
time.
We never left. It's like me in Blue Books. You know, it's like some of us never left. But okay, and so Lewis always has these little zingers to close.
Yeah,
right?
This is so good.
Okay, at the end of the first. Okay. And all the time, such is the tragic comedy of our situation. We continue to clamor for those very qualities we are rendering impossible. You can hardly open a periodical without coming across the statement that what our civilization needs is more drive or dynamism or self-sacrifice or creativity. In a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. Who writes like that?
Yeah.
That's an incredible paragraph.
That's right. Maybe a little graphic, but okay. All right.
But analyze that for me in English.
Yeah. Well, that was English.
Okay. In American.
So we want the fruits of the virtue.
Yeah.
While calling virtue vice.
Exactly.
Yeah, the inverse of this is treating the symptom and not the disease.
Yeah, sure.
It's the same thing.
Absolutely. So that's great stuff. So scientism or logical positive is actually what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've just mumbled through that positivism. So logical positivism, we would call that scientism. That science does not just look at that which is and make inferences from observation, but it actually decides what is real
true.
And
yeah.
what is true. The ontology. So he writes about this a lot, and that's really what he's getting at through English. Most people don't know that what we would have called mid-20th century subjectivism, or all the stuff people were fighting against when you were in elementary school and I was in high school and you were
not born yet.
Not born yet.
yeah, all that came into American education in the 1950s and 60s through the English departments.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you own the language, you can control people's view of reality.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so he wrote Men Without Chests. That's great. He has an essay in one of those books called On Bulverism, Bulverism. And I don't know why he didn't. He made up this guy, the work of Bulver. You want me to get this microphone?
Oh, that's good.
Is that about right? Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, I can. I'm multi-talented. So, Bulver. He said this guy named Bulver who thinks what he was talking about was reductionism. Well, all that is this. Or you're only saying that because you grew up in a Christian home, or whatever it is. So you are reducing somebody simply to a product of their environment, and that there's nothing else. And the kind of reductionism I accuse you of is
different,
slightly different,
yeah,
but still fun.
The kind of reductionism you accuse me of is that I'm a one-trick pony. Always goes back to the same thing.
But
vocation.
To be fair, that's like
it's true.
So am I. We said different ponies.
Yes.
So, okay. So he says it's reductionism to reduce somebody to the sum of their experiences. It's a little bit like what Chesterton said about Skinner, that if you reduce a man's existence and character to a product of his environment, we would do well to remember that boiling oil is an environment. In other words, behave this way. That's an orthodoxy. But behave this way or I'll put you in boiling oil. Mm-hmm. And look what we've done. So that's his view of Skinner. So, Bulverism, reductionism, and that's Hegel as well. So you've got this view, and then there's this counter view. The truth must be somewhere in between. It's never actually true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so he says scientism actually does that. There's nothing that can ever be true if there's nothing outside of science to be true. The myth became fact is Jesus.
Yeah.
Writing as Jesus, he says some myths point to a, and that's
the
mythopoeia. Yeah. There we are.
I'm going to get Brent Olson in the studio because he does this with Old Testament theology.
Good.
Well, I think he had Clive Kilby too at Whedon. I'm not sure.
Probably, yeah.
I think he did.
But so Brent's whole deal is that the Exodus is the true version of pagan myths.
Yeah. Yeah. And he talks about this.
Yeah.
He did a dissertation on it.
Okay, preview, Brent, we're going to get Brent talking about this.
Brent's got
theology.
Brent is so well read.
That's good.
So much more than we.
Yeah, that's good.
Not a one-trick pony.
No.
By any stretch.
Like a three-trick pony.
Okay, so it's three-ring circus, right? He wrote a lot against what we would call today scientism because that was prevalent then. Mm-hmm. It's prevalent now, although people are pushing back on it. Okay, his biggest problem with logical positivism, that's the philosophical version of scientism, Wittgenstein.
Yes.
Okay, so his biggest problem with it is that science doesn't work. If you see the world through the lens of what we would call scientism, science itself doesn't work because science has to be inside the system to make the observations. Mm-hmm. And that the moment you step outside the system now, it's now a narrative. It makes metaphysical claims,
mm-hmm. Yep.
Which it says it can't do.
And yeah, the apologetic to that is all of the great scientific discoveries have happened under a Christian worldview.
Correct.
And so it's like, okay, the East Asians had all these brilliant, brilliant scientists, but they never got to a point because they expected that the world functioned in a different way. Mm-hmm. But the science came from expecting that the world reflected a transcendent designer, which meant that they followed what they were observed to its logical conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. Okay, here's the last one. Okay. This is a little broad. Okay, so progressivism, meaning very broadly progressivism. Mm-hmm. So politically, communism. In philosophy, historicism. The idea that history just is and we're marching through it.
He made a comment in, I forget if it's his testimony. His writing of his testimony, but he comes up with this idea of chronological snobbery.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's genius. It's so genius. But
that
in
go ahead
that the we in our so scientific culture today, we assume that the ancients of the past were stupid just because we have technology that is better. The science is more testable, repeatable. And so we assume our own greatness, our own progressive, we're getting better and better, instead of having the humility to say maybe some of the, the classics actually had it right. Maybe Plato wasn't dumb.
Yeah,
maybe
what shattered Aristotle that for had him? Something. Yeah. What, World War One?
Yeah.
Okay, it's hard to argue we're getting better and better every day.
Yeah. So. And it shattered for a lot of people.
A
lot of people.
Yeah, it took about a century for postmillennialism to come back.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, so also evolution. Now, when you read Lewis, at a surface level, you're going to think he's an evolutionist. All he's doing is talking to the culture. Everybody was an evolutionist and an anti-Semite, so for that matter. So you're going to get into various conversations that were happening in the culture. He was doing it as a cultural apologetic. He was not an evolutionist. And that is a philosophical, that's a philosophical position that he held. So, okay, historicism, God as his, let's see, God as writing history as his story, if you would. That's not where the word comes from, but it's cute, okay?
It works in English.
Versus history being, yeah, not German, versus history being God. So you want to be on the right side of history. That, when you hear that, that's what's happening. Is that there's this train moving. The train is it's
inevitable.
And the train is actually matter, which in the Hegelian worldview is matter is self-existing, self-informing, self-creating, and self-sustaining. Okay, so you have to get with the program,
right?
Because you're just stardust. So he writes against that. He writes about the myth of progress. Is progress even possible? How do we know we're progressing if there is no objective truth? Because you and I have different desires. And again, back to that argument from desire. We have different desires. How can we really identify what progress is? In one of those books, there's a lecture called Two Lectures, which sounds like a sermon. It's like two sermons, right? Okay, so he says, as far as origins go, we have to come to grips with two problems. First, it started with something. You can't have nothing and then work with it. So even evolution has to start with something.
Right.
And secondly, growth through stages and changes of life or time isn't macroevolution, molecules to man. It's not even really microevolution. You know, something becoming a better version of something. It's simple maturity. So he calls that out. And then the last one, this is the last one that I'll highlight of his hundreds of essays. Okay. The Funeral of a Great Myth. It's great. It's a great write. It's a great writing. And he kind of does this obituary for the great myth. The great myth is evolution. And he says it's not that it's false. It's that it can't be true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it makes metaphysical claims. And so then he writes in this pure essay form, why then it's perseverance. And it's because it is the story that takes over the narrative of the true history that God has given us. You need something to replace God. You can't just wash your hands of him.
Yep.
It's the red balloon. So
it was Lewis that in teaching apologetics, it was Lewis that helped intelligent design click for me as an apologetics against evolution. The right question isn't, is there a God and how do I demonstrate that? The right question is, why is there anything at all?
Yeah.
If evolution is taking us down a thought pattern, everything is randomly colliding atoms in space, under those conditions, we would expect nothing to exist. But there's something, and it was Lewis like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's what helped. Christian apologetics, in a well-intentioned way, Christian apologists end up working really hard to answer the wrong questions sometimes. And Lewis is a guy who helps reframe the situation so you're asking the right questions.
Yeah.
The modernistic presuppositions of a certain era of apologetics were unfortunate.
Yep.
And so the idea of, oh, I'm not sure I really buy Jonah, so I need to find a story of some Norwegian fisherman who was swallowed by a whale. And then now I can say that the book of Jonah is true.
Yeah, you're working for plausibility, and it's just ridiculous.
And that's not the point. The point of Lazarus' resurrection isn't that men rise from the dead all the time. What's the big deal? It's a miracle, and it's an exception. And the way Lewis talks about miracles, he says it's not God suspending the order of things. That miracles are when we get a glimpse at the reality that really is.
Yeah.
I
so
love that.
It's beautiful. Yeah, it's oh, and there's that's a big philosophical flex. Because when we talk about miracles, is, well, God just kind of, you know, just
hit the pause button and then went
and then did what he, and God can do that because God can do anything. That there's problems with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now I promised Maddie we would round it all the way back to the literature and the fiction. And, yeah.
Can
and
I
maybe
hold my
books?
Yeah. Thank you.
My starting point on all of this is how Lewis describes this in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah.
And so the witch, Jadis, the queen, thinks she traps Aslan on a technicality. And so Aslan substitutes himself for the price of a traitor. Mm-hmm. And then how Aslan explains the gospel in the environment of Narnia is there's a deeper magic.
Right.
And that's where the philosophy goes back to the narrative.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because he takes those, we would even call them, like metaphysics.
Yeah.
And takes that into a children's story that they can understand, that this working of evil has no power over the one who wrote the story. And when we trust the author of metaphysics, when we know the author of metaphysics, when you believe in the Christian story, you can have that confidence that what you know is true.
And that's the strength. That's also the message, the outcome of the space trilogy.
Yep.
The same thing, which is as soon as I read Perelandra, like instantly one of my two or three favorite books.
Mm-hmm.
I love that as an exploration of metaphysics.
Yeah.
The Perelandra is a retelling of Genesis.
Remind me, is that Mars or Venus?
Venus.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So or is that a spoiler?
No, it's fine. It's okay. it's the middle novel. So
it was written in like way long ago.
Yeah.
If people haven't read it at this point,
it took me longer. It took me longer than I'd like to admit to figure out he was talking about Mars and Venus.
Yeah.
It was so. Space trilogy is pre World War II, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So
yes.
So you got the Out of the Silent Planet is the main character Elwyn Ransom, his trip to Mars, and its setup is really what it is. There's some pretty deep underlying philosophical truths going on there, but mm-hmm. it's a good story.
And he's doing Pilgrim's Progress a little bit, right?
A little bit, yeah. And which is interesting because Lewis writes Pilgrim's Regress.
Yeah.
But then he gets to Perelandra, and the entire nature of the story changes because now Ransom becomes the Christ figure.
Yes, the messenger.
The
of
messenger.
The good news.
Yeah. To a pre-fall Venus.
Yeah.
Or the name for Venus from medieval literature is Perelandra.
Yeah. And the whole narrative, the battle is between the messenger of the good news about who God is versus the unman.
Which is the greatest.
So genius.
His handling of the unman is mind-bogglingly good.
Yep.
The way he presents evil. And so there's this scene. It's not really a spoiler alert, but Elwyn Ransom, the main character, meets this guy who was a character in the first book and now is a corrupted version mm-hmm. of himself, and he succeeds in removing the guy from corrupting the Eve figure on Perelandra. Mm-hmm. But now they're on this voyage across the sea, and the way Lewis presents evil is by annoyance
mm-hmm.
and not by a moral evil. And so there's a couple pages where Ransom, Ransom, mm-hmm. Ransom, and then he snaps, "What?" And the young man goes, "Nothing." And he does it over and over. And you start, like my blood pressure went up mm-hmm. as I'm reading these pages. And it's like the commentary on good versus evil and the nature of the Christian story, not a commentary on fiction or nonfiction, but the narrative.
Because in that narrative, he's getting to the point of evil is the lack of all good reason.
Yeah.
It's not even that it was so maniacal, this person's temptation or annoyance or whatever was so developed or well-reasoned. It was just petty.
Yeah.
And without any mm-hmm. sort of substance. And so Ransom is then the only one out of the two that has any sort of substantive reality, which I think is a fascinating commentary on the way
disappears.
That we think. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so then Ransom ends up being the quasi main character of Hideous Strength.
Mm-hmm.
And then because Lewis just wanted to increase the degree of difficulty on storytelling just a little bit, he folds in the Arthur legend.
Yeah.
And remind me, what was the name of the, what was nice? What did it stand for?
the National Institute of, oh man, well, another comment. I can't remember. It's the National, so it's this, it's the science-based know-all, be-all, end-all.
Who then, in Lewis's narrative, is taken over by demonic activity. By,
yeah, it represents demonic activity, yeah. Which is brilliant. And Ransom is the Pendragon.
Yep.
And the upshot is they bring back Merlin just for fun.
Just for fun, they bring back Merlin. Yeah.
It's just a crazy story when you try to describe it, but it works.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's cool. And
you are such a nerd.
I love it. I cannot get enough of it.
He's working in his English heritage.
Yeah.
And even going back to the Arthurian legend of that is the myth of the English people, and even trying to redeem the cultural story behind that through the gospel, I think.
Churchill talked about that too. Good, is that with the gospel?
Yeah, which is what, so you really want me to geek out right now? This is it. In That Hideous Strength, Lewis is doing the exact same thing Tolkien does with Lord of the Rings.
Doesn't he even mention, like, if you're going to have to know the background of that, you're going to have to wait for the published book of my best friend.
Yeah.
You know,
it's the mythology of the British Isles. Yes. And so then, like you said, Lewis ends up being a cultural apologist, which is exactly what That Hideous Strength ends up representing, is that he brings back the British myth, but ties it to creation.
Yeah.
He ties it to the truth.
The true things.
Yep.
This is fun.
Yep.
So if you haven't, if the gentle listener is still listening.
That's a big if.
If you've never read any Lewis, probably. If you're a nonfiction person, probably Mere Christianity.
You start with Mere Christianity and then Screwtape.
If you're fiction, okay, but Screwtape Letters is fiction, but it's like it's not.
Yeah.
It's anti-nonfiction.
It's theology, but that's what it, yeah.
Yeah, so, but if you're just looking for a story, if you're the kind of person you need a hook, it's probably Chronicles of Narnia.
If you haven't read Narnia, you start there regardless.
Mm-hmm.
If you have read Narnia and haven't read Space Trilogy, you need to do that just to kind of compare them. And then from there...
Okay, Space Trilogy, you just got to press through the first book.
A little bit. You got to press through the first, probably half of
first
the first
half of
book,
the first book.
And then it moves.
Yep.
After that, it sucks you in. And then some necessities. You really need A Grief Observed.
Yeah.
Problem of Pain with that, you said.
Yeah.
You really need to read The Abolition of Man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's short.
Yeah, that's
short.
Really
short. Oh, and on YouTube, C.S. Lewis doodles, if you're visual. Okay. Used to have one
and
for The
of
Abolition
of Man. And a lot
of them
have the recording, the Mere Christianity recordings.
Yeah, the original World War II broadcasts are on YouTube.
Yep.
Background biographical information, there's a documentary/quasi-film on Amazon called C.S. Lewis, The Reluctant Convert. That's brilliant. That'll give you fill in the blanks on the background. There's
Focus
just
on
so
the
much...
family radio theater. Did C.S. Lewis at War, which was, I mean, it was dramatized, but it's you know, fairly. So I guess really what we're saying is we're trying to get you on a gateway drug.
Yes. Yeah. Get hooked.
First hit is free. But
that's right.
They're just the point of it is there's so much content out there. It's all worth your time. You will be deeply enriched by going down the rabbit hole just a little bit on this, I think.
So three of our courses here touch on C.S. Lewis.
At least three. So
maybe
my
four.
Class is Intro to Christian Thought. C.S. Lewis is one of the Christian thinkers that we profile in the second half of the semester. Apologetics, Ethics, and Christian Thought. We really lean into the trilemma in C.S. Lewis's apologetics.
Mm-hmm. So good. Well, Lewis and Friends
C.S. Lewis
is
and
all
friends.
About literature.
That's an elective.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So we're not teaching this instead of the Bible.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Just making that clear.
Well, it's been a pleasure. This has been a lot of fun, at least for three of us, maybe four. Luke's had occasional positive reactions to us. Reach out to us if you have questions. There's plenty of ways we can steer you.